You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is Wednesday, February 16th, 2022, and this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Just so you know, I'm not going to be here next week. Some of you know I'm getting married, and I'm going off thanks to a very nice tax refund on my honeymoon, and I'll be back in early next month. And you know, I'm marrying a right wing woman who, believe it or not, comes out of the mental health field. Usually, they create a lot of muddle headed idiots. And I don't know if I mentioned this, but I met her because she was thrown off Facebook for attacking, you know, the masks and the COVID nonsense. And it's been extraordinary. This is something that I've been waiting for some time. And I'm telling you, I think maybe there are seven or eight good women left in America. I took one of them. I mean, I took, like, you know, 10% of them. So, sorry, if you're single, there's like seven left for you to find. So, and I'm not someone to be taken in by flights of fancy or some sort of hormonal haze that has me see, you know, whoever I'm with as this goddess. I'm red pilled enough to be resistant to that. The testing was mutual. We both come from very abusive backgrounds, with adultery and everything else. So, we were very distrustful at first, but, this has been, let me put it this way. I know precisely what I'm doing. And, if I have to eat my words, I doubt it, but, you know, I'm 50 years old. If I don't know how to spot a phony by now, then I deserve what I get. So I've also, last week told you about the fundraising. Updates, my PO box, my Bitcoin wallet, and the, new link that I've put all over the place, to another donation platform. No different than PayPal, and you don't have to have an account or anything. It's worked very well. And I've also noted, and I want to thank those who have joined my Patreon and then did their donating from there. This is, you know, we're as I've already told you, I've lost my PayPal, lost my Facebook. God knows what else I'm going to lose in the future. And this is only the beginning. I believe martial law or something like it has been declared in Canada, despite the fact that nothing, you know, the police and military were told to stand down in America as white leftists burned down cities. Here, because of the anti-lockdown movement, of course, it's a totally different story. And the same goes for Russia, in a very similar relationship, that when the Soviet Union existed, trade between the U.S. and Russia was brisk and profitable. As soon as they detached themselves from the left, suddenly they become evil incarnate. And the lies get worse and worse to the point now I simply can't read mainstream. And, you know, my knowledge of the area is so extensive, and American journalists and academics so ignorant, that it's really in my interest that I not read mainstream. Sorry, I hear about it secondhand. That's good enough for me. And but one aspect of warfare, as many of you know, is that it gives an excuse, one of the reasons for it too, and it gives an excuse for the regime to destroy its domestic opposition. Because now someone like me will be told that he is an affront to national security. Not just that I'm, you know, evil or wrong, but now, you know, presenting an objective harm to American foreign policy. And I want you guys to remember, too, I wrote a book, I think it was 2016, on the American military. Essentially, it's called The Foreign Policy of Mass Society, The Failure of Western Engagement in the Islamic World. And to a great extent, this is really an attack on American military policy and how it's developed over the years, especially NATO. And I want to talk a bit about, a few concepts that I bring up there. And this is one of these books I keep, you know, I keep forgetting about. I do this all the time. And since NATO is one of the new, one of the major players in the Ukraine crisis, I have a chapter here entitled NATO as Ideology, Liberalism by the Barrel of a Gun. And I want to talk about a few concepts that come up there. I cite the 2008 strategic concept that comes from the U.S. Department of Defense, and showing the defense establishment, both in NATO and in the U.S., as deeply ideological. Let me give you two quotes here. The first one is, and this is a justification for military intervention in places like Ukraine. Like communism and fascism before it, extremist ideology has transnational pretensions. And like its secular antecedents, it draws adherents from around the world. The vision it offers is in opposition to globalization and the expansion of freedom it brings. So the official strategic plan, the concept of the Pentagon states that it is here and it exists to defend globalization, which it then equates with something they term freedom. So they make it very clear that when they refer to, you know, stupid slogans like fighting for freedom, they mean globalization. And then they talk about irregular warfare. And this is significant because this is the specialty of the Donbas forces. And they say this. They say, and this is not in reference to them, this is before that happened, but it says, in terms of guerrilla warfare, it says, this conflict is a prolonged irregular campaign, a violent struggle for legitimacy and influence over the population. The use of force plays a role, yet military efforts to capture or kill terrorists are likely to be subordinate to measures to promote local participation in government and economic programs to spur development, as well as efforts to understand and address the grievances that often lie at the heart of insurgencies. Now, I quote these, again, directly from the Department of Defense in 2008, and of course nothing has changed, because they speak to the approach to warfare, the approach to intervention and violence, both of the Pentagon itself and NATO. The definition of warfare itself is being revised. Warfare and war are terms that are being redefined. There is no front. And you think of World War I and World War II, there was a front that you could be sent to. There was no front in Vietnam either. So the claim is the only way to deal with anti-American movements around the world is to work at the economic or political level in addition to the military one. But of course it makes sense because the empire has no money. Its manpower shortages are extremely well known. Its military failures are substantial. It has no other options. The problem, even worse, and this was long before, this was just as the mortgage crisis destroyed the American economy and plunged into a depression, and certainly before COVID, Now, the Eurasian Union, Russia, China, etc., have far more money, far more stability. They have far more gold. They have far more people. They have far more everything than the U.S. does. So to deal with so-called extremists, and we're talking about, you know, Russian nationalists in the Donbass here, I think this specifically was for Islamic extremists, but it really doesn't matter. Its application is very wide. The strategy now is not really to confront them directly, but in assisting countries to deal with internal instability, which is another term for a color revolution. The significance further is that this is as much a part of the new definition of warfare as guns and tanks. This concept that governs the Pentagon, and to a great extent NATO, it assumes that the main reason for the existence of anti-liberal, anti-American groups they call terror groups and irregular forces is economic deprivation. That's a materialist assumption common to both Marxists and capitalists. Therefore, the assumption, of course, is that if the economy improves, those anti-American groups will lose support. Of course, it assumes a capitalist economy. It assumes that the enemies of liberalism are not assisting it, in fact, are the ones engendering this support. It assumes all this. And again, I don't know, you know, the military censors who dealt with this aren't exactly known for their nuance. But all told, the fact that globalization has to be regularly defended by armies and propaganda and papers like this suggests itself that their definition of free trade, which is, you know, one of the essential critical pillars of globalization, needs to be defended itself. And that becomes the new definition of warfare. And so ideology is essential. Now, more specifically, when it comes to NATO itself, Vanda Felbab Brown gave testimony to the Armed Services Committee in August of 2015, and she refuted many of the claims of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the Defense Department, in this case specifically concerning Afghanistan. And now we know, of course, as I predicted in this book and elsewhere, the miserable failure of the empire there. And in fact, the book's title has the word failure in it. Here's something that she said in this, in her testimony. Despite the substantial improvements of Afghan security forces, which, by the way, you gotta laugh. I mean, God almighty. Few Afghans believe that a better future is on the horizon after 2014. Although NATO and U.S. officials remain optimistic about the success of the counterinsurgency and stabilization campaign, many fear there will be a renewed outbreak of civil war after, this is obviously in 2014, not 15, 2014, when the NATO presence is much reduced. During that period of the initial post-Taliban hope and promise, governance in Afghanistan became defined by weakly functioning state institutions unable and unwilling to uniformly enforce laws and policies. And then, after that, a bit later, she said, local government officials have had only a limited capacity and motivation to redress the broader governance deficiencies. The level of inter-elite infighting, much of it along ethnic and regional lines, is at its peak. The result is pervasive hedging on the part of key power brokers, including the resurrection of semi-clandestine or officially sanctioned militias. A disturbing big unknown is whether the ANA, or the Afghan army, which is, will be able to withstand the ethnic and patronage factionalization that is already to some extent fracturing the institution. The ANP has, of course, been notorious both for such intense ethnic factionalization as well as for corruption. Worse yet, the ANP remains notorious for being the perpetrator of many crimes. Among the most controversial aspects of the transition strategy in Afghanistan are various efforts to stand up self-defense forces around the country. Now, this shows the ridiculous naivete of people like her. And this is actually earlier She stated that, I mean, this was years ago. The Pentagon was never optimistic, except very early on, about the situation in Afghanistan or anywhere else. They're not optimistic about the performance of American military forces there. And we all know why. But by the time I wrote this book, 2016, that pessimistic view was mainstream. As far as her testimony is concerned, that's rarely been cited. I was saying then, and I stated clearly, the military approach in Afghanistan has not succeeded at any level, despite at that time spending of over $1 trillion. It doesn't matter anyway, because even if somehow the U.S. had defeated its made-up enemies in that country, and this you could say this really for any place, especially in the third world, even if they had won, the Afghan units that the U.S. had trained had no intention of maintaining the American ideology once the Western forces left. So even amongst its local allies, American military forces are seen, even at the local level, as nothing more than mercenaries of American capital. And you don't need to be a political scientist to see this. Academics and journalists don't see it, because they're told what to do, which is why newspapers, news magazines, television says the exact same thing using the exact same phrases and words. And as I said at the time, this is, you know, a while ago, that groups like the Taliban are not unpopular, and they have nothing to do with economic deprivation. The West, whether it be in Russia or Ukraine or in Afghanistan, Iran, the West is seen, the U.S. in particular, as that entity that has created poverty and deprivation. And I said, you know, going way back, by myself, I was saying that given the Taliban's very early success against the drug trade, and its resumption once they were removed from power, is very suspicious, and which meant that the Taliban and groups like it are becoming more and more popular as time went on. There was a short time where I was the only one who seemed to notice this, because I'm pretty sure I was the only one who defended the Taliban as a political, not a religious war, but as a political organization. So rebuilding a war-torn economy, as I've said, requires something like the Taliban force. And not just rebuilding the infrastructure, but rebuilding the psyche. And I've said about the Taliban in the past, a group was either required to impose a strict religious rule on a country that is scarred by war. I mean, factional strife, like extreme poverty. Several generations, at least, brutalized by warfare and the amorality that it creates. And there are people who believe that somehow liberal democracy, I can't imagine the argument how it would go that liberal democracy can fix these problems and fix them at the barrel of a gun, because liberalism always requires armies to impose it and force and violence and mercenaries and everything else to impose it. It requires privately owned capital to force itself on a society. And yet this is precisely what the U.S. and NATO are exporting. This is a revolutionary ideology, the French revolutionary ideology, coming from on what would amount to conservative parts of the world, and this also would include Russia and Ukraine. I think the best way to describe it, I don't care what crisis we're talking about here, is, well, I'll quote myself here. I stated, the U.S. is now left revolutionary, Jacobin spreading the doctrine of Darwin, progress, capitalism, and feminism to the cosmos, meaning to the world. That is what the U.S. is. And the Islamic world, and of course the Slavic world, quietly amongst the elites, and not so quietly in the street, are well aware of this, and have been well aware of this for a very long time. Now moving to NATO itself. 2010. You know, armies, defense departments have their strategic concept. They all have this basic mission statement. So NATO has its own
strategic concept in 2010, and it says this. NATO member states form a unique community of values committed to the principles of individual liberty, democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. On the one hand, and I've said, you know, Edmund Burke said this, John Adams said this, on the one hand, these terms are extremely vague. They don't stand for anything. They're negatives. You know, it's like, you know, standing for fighting and taking up arms to defend a trial by jury or something like that. On the other hand, they're not so vague. When, and I do this all the time, when you unpack those slogans and you reduce them to their essentials, you get the ideological core, the foundation of what NATO is. And it comes down to the imposition of the Western model of corporate liberal capitalism on the world, and in this case, the Slavic Orthodox world and the Slavic Catholic world too. And of course, we all know there is no tradition or interest in such ideologies in Afghanistan or Ukraine or anywhere else. And I'll say it again, liberalism always has to be imposed by force and violence. This is one of the major works where I make the statement that this obnoxious, pseudo-pious doctrine holds that so-called democracy is the same as liberalism. And it's true. That's how the term is used. And it is, you know, classic manipulation. Don't forget the Ba'ath Party, which I've supported, at least ideologically, for a very long time, and the Social Nationalist Party, which are very similar in ideology, are banned in Iraq and Afghanistan, at least under the American occupation. So, for example, when Hamas, to use another example, when they swept the Palestinian elections in 2006, they were immediately condemned by NATO and the U.S. as undemocratic. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Hamas dominated the elections. How could a party be undemocratic if they won an election without the, you know, destroying it, their opponents? They're legitimately popular. No one denies that. It's because democracy does not refer to a process. Most people assume democracy has something to do with campaigns, elections, and voting. It doesn't. It means the domination of corporate liberalism and everything that that implies. In the same document, now this is NATO's founding concept, continuing concept. And it states that one of NATO's essential missions is to, quote, further develop NATO's capacity to defend against the threat of chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons of mass destruction, end quote. Which is funny, because the buildup of nuclear forces now has increased as the U.S. has pulled out of all of the former treaties with the Soviet Union. They were willing to, treaties that were signed with the Soviet Union that have been enforced up until recently. Because when it was against the Soviet Union, it was perfectly acceptable to create the anti-war movement, to create the anti-nuke movement. Somehow, though, against the Eurasian and social nationalist East, now the use of nuclear weapons is considered legitimate, all of a sudden. And there is no anti-war movement. Proving the point, I mean, without doubt in this case, that the anti-war movement was a creation of the regime. Now we all know that Israel used chemical weapons on the Gaza Strip, and they did it in Lebanon as well earlier, admitted in 2006. Jacob Edry, who was a member of the Israeli cabinet at the time, he said, quote, the Israeli army made use of phosphorus shells during the war against Hezbollah in attacks against military targets in open ground, end quote. That was in USA Today. That came out in 2012. It was in 2006. It's been admitted many times. Unfortunately for them, of course, Hezbollah and Hamas are legitimately, not just popular, but massively popular among Arabs in the occupied territories, especially Gaza, partially due to this kind of policy. NATO would love you to believe that somehow the rule of law and elections and everything else mean some kind of objectivity, equal distance among political parties, but that's not the case. They ban political parties. Not the leftist one, but those that stand for some version of nationalism. Largely because they simply can't argue against them, and largely because the entire concept of both the Pentagon and NATO are to destroy them. NATO talking about, you know, chemical weapons on the one hand, and on the other, cheering on Israel's gas attack on Gaza, is very typical of organizations like that. Now, Israel's not a member of NATO, but she's a key ally of almost all NATO members. So the ideology is the imposition of liberalism, feminism, individualism, secularism, and capitalism throughout the world by all means necessary, including chemical and nuclear weapons, including propaganda, including banning political parties, including shutting down anything, any outlet that may be remotely of a dissident nature. You have the suburban neocons. And the best way to describe them is this, they seek the messianic rule of Protestant nominalism and Zionist fundamentalism. These are the people. And of course, you know, since the middle class has been hollowed out, they don't have the force that they used to. But they still, their elites in Washington and Northern Virginia get a huge number of elite grants every year. But they are the most vocal promoters of this idea. So in all these cases, the very fundamental concept of the Pentagon and NATO is to force liberalism, which is a totalitarian ideology based on corporate capital and the state capital alliance, what I call the regime, on a people who are clearly hostile to it. There is no support in Russia or Ukraine or anywhere else in that part of the world for NATO or the EU. Discount everything that the mainstream media is talking about in that respect. The U.S. hold, again, to use Afghanistan as an example, the American elites argue that Afghanistan can be saved from illiberalism just so long as enough money is spent on it. And no one really takes this view seriously outside of the universities. And you still have that old neocon idea. And there's plenty of people in the Pentagon who hold this, but many who don't. The assumption that the world is just waiting for liberal capitalism to be imposed from above, since the Pentagon's concept explicitly says that that is the same thing as freedom. And they assume, furthermore, that the preferences, ideological and otherwise, of the entire world, let alone the poverty-stricken states of Afghanistan, those preferences are identical to that. Now, I spent a lot of time in the past talking about energy resources, but I agree with Alexander Dugin in this case that that is of limited utility here. It is a part of it, but it's a increasingly small part of it, largely because the BlackRock and Vanguard investment groups that control corporate America are explicitly hostile to it, fossil fuels, etc. But even in that area, I mean, the one huge failure outside of the military area is in energy. Russia, Belarus, China, Iran, Kazakhstan, they form, among others, form a huge trading bloc that has far greater access and knowledge concerning its own region and its economics and its resources. The U.S. has been forced out to a great extent, and they fill the gap. I'll repeat to you again, the Western world, NATO and the U.S., has no resources or will for a global war. Afghanistan is just one example. The Afghan government, security forces, and police, this is prior to the Taliban victory, were seen by even their allies as incompetent and corrupt. They were seen by American soldiers. I've heard, a YouTube interview by the hundreds, seen as American soldiers as incompetent and corrupt. And the Russians were well aware that the drug trade coming from northern Afghanistan to Western Europe via Georgia will only be stopped, of course, with the Taliban victory. I don't know, and maybe you could help me on this, to what extent the government that now rules in Afghanistan has taken action against this. I can only imagine that, you know, the anti-heroin, the brutal anti-heroin idea has been a critical pillar of the Taliban since its inception. Remember, one of my favorite politicians in the Philippines, President of the Philippines, made it his life's work to destroy, in that case, the meth trade in the Philippines. And he did it to a great extent and was immediately and instantaneously condemned by the U.S. government and the embassy. The drug trade is too important to the West. The U.S. and all of NATO are, as I've stated many times, long past bankruptcy. You know, this book came out before the crash of 08 and it came out before COVID. And even then, they were facing very high unemployment and they show every sign of depression. I've stated before that the media has been ordered to never use the word depression relative to economics. I'm not talking about mental depression, I'm talking about the Great Depression. They say recession, the Great Recession, anything but depression. The only time that that was lifted was when Trump was president. But even then, it was used rarely. Better news, though, is that, and I've said this many times, that most NATO members, as of right now, are opposed to NATO's involvement in warfare pretty much anywhere. The Germans, the French, the Italians have made that very clear. The British, so many, they have said, we are not going to contribute soldiers to this adventure. The fact that Germany, you know, years ago made a separate deal, which, you know, comes out as the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which empties out into Germany without any EU, you know, direct EU support with Russia, shows just how short-sighted NATO's policy is. By 2012, the Washington Post was forced to report that two-thirds of Americans claim that the war in Afghanistan is not worth fighting. If you remember, it was right after that that this make-believe, or not make-believe, this Western-created group called ISIS came into existence. I said it at the time, I was the first one to say it, that ISIS came into existence precisely when that article came out, and a few others like it, that the U.S. was turning vehemently against a war that made no sense and was entered into under the, you know, frenzy of the post-9/11 nonsense. But even as far as Ukraine is concerned, any of these wars, there's never any clear purpose, so there's no way to judge whether or not it's successful. There's no international agreement. There's no local consensus. There's no money. So the question remains almost nonsensical. You have people like Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan and the present government in Ukraine. They're very similar. Karzai himself even condemned the U.S. Presence in Afghanistan and accused the U.S. of all kinds of war crimes, despite the fact that they installed him. The night raids. I mean, I've reported on the use of incendiary weapons against farmers in Syria. And these are like mafia-style attacks designed to keep any, you know, this was a few years ago, to keep any food resources from the Syrian government. They were torching defenseless villages and coming home and pinning medals on themselves. Karzai, and now, of course, you have the president of Ukraine, who is strongly moving away from the invasion hypothesis, which, of course, is nonsensical. There is not a shred of evidence that this exists, nor is there any interest for it to exist. However, they have a real reason. The best thing that could happen to Ukraine is that it comes under Russian control. It will then very quickly be brought out of the fourth world where it currently is, and that's been proven in Crimea. So the only rational response, as you could figure out, is this disengagement. No one believes outside of Northern Virginia that the U.S. Has any interest in eastern Ukraine. I know you've heard it before, but the U.S. military is undermanned, overstretched, and increasingly reliant on poor equipment. Budgets are not being cut. They increase every year, although commanders claim that the budget is being cut. It's kind of an excuse. It's like, you know, the Russian invasion idea has been around since at least 2014. Every few months, there's this breathless news article about a Russian invasion. Now, today, what's particularly dangerous, and we talked about irregulars, what they don't bother to mention is that the Western world, because of that fact, uses irregular mercenary forces all the time. Machiavelli stated, and of course the oligarchic republics in North Italy use mercenaries so they wouldn't have a domestic army to overthrow them, that mercenaries are extremely unreliable. They don't have the motive that a national army would have, and that they, you know, serve the highest bidder. So, you know, and there's something else, and I'm surprised that I have not done a specific show on this. But I still remain the only one to talk about the repression, the manipulation of casualty figures. I have a paper that I haven't referenced in a while. American casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan, cooking the books, question mark. I wrote this in 2017. And the argument, and because I read a lot of Russian blogs and military websites in the original that are not available to most people, I came to the startling conclusion that American casualty statistics for those two wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, are false. The claim was, in Afghanistan, the Taliban was simply crushed with ease. The Americans said that 800 Taliban were killed in the initial attack in 2001, but Iranian and Afghan sources said there were 8 killed. I never bought that story because the Taliban at the time were battle-hardened. They were veterans. And most of the Americans were anything but. They were green, unpopular, and far from home. Now in Iraq, this myth is very similar, but is even more absurd. Now, remember, you know, I was in college, the first Iraq war, Desert Shield breaks out. The claim of, you know, weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein is gassing everybody, the American military is in danger of chemical assault, all nonsense. But, and of course, you know, as I was 18 years old, 19, I fell for it, but very quickly I turned on. At the time, under Saddam Hussein, who was a decent man put into an almost impossible situation, the Iraqi army of the day was first class. It was Soviet trained, and it was a machine. About 900,000 battle-hardened men in the unfortunate war with Iran. The war ended in 1988, which meant that they had 2 years for the economy to recover and replenish its losses. At the time, they were deeply dug in. They were waiting for the American attack. Their anti-aircraft batteries were Soviet-made and very well put together. And we were told that the green American army rolled over all this with no difficulty, almost with no casualties. Has this ever happened in the history of war? So I came across in 2003 the Foreign Military Review, which is a Russian language journal, connected with the Russian military establishment to some extent, published its own intelligence statistics for the Iraq war. And the author here was Colonel Svidorov. And he stated that the U.S. has an accounting method that deliberately understates and underestimates its losses. And they're understated partially due to the existence of paid mercenaries that the U.S. was using, taking a large percentage of the loss. They talk about Americans or mercenary for whatever, because mercenary are not considered part of the American army despite being under American, being paid by the UN, those killed in what they call terrorist attacks are not and never listed among official casualties. Now, what is a terrorist attack? That is defined by the commander of the unit where the dead soldier served. Now, as much as I have been a critic of the American military, no one wants to see American or any other boys killed. And, of course, we know it's going to be men. Women are not killed in battle. So, for example, this came Bolochenkov, who wrote in 2016, half the losses in various patrols against Iraqi guerrillas do not appear in casualty statistics. Russian intelligence, and this is India and Iran and elsewhere, they argue, and it's true, that non-Americans bore the brunt of the major assaults, whether it be the newly minted Iraqi soldiers of the day or so-called coalition members from the Middle East. That was the first wave of the attack. Kuwait had a force of 140,000 at America's disposal. The Turks, of course, had put a huge army on the Iraqi border, forcing Saddam Hussein to split his army in two. But they contributed at least 5,000 to the initial attack of actual regular forces. Bahrain had 3,000, etc. The suppression of the Shiite uprising in Fallujah were Muslims fighting for the Americans. The NCOs were non-American. The thought was that it would make more sense than, you know, white Americans attacking a non-white city, that it would be more acceptable for Muslims to do it. So the local collaborators, the PMC, the private military companies, have been studiously ignored by the press then and now, but they were significant. At the same time, friendly fire. Those deaths and injuries are not reported as official casualties. Soldiers dying without the presence of a bullet or shrapnel are also ignored and not included in the casualty list. And that's in the Volume 4, the Foreign Military Review, pages 2 to 7. And soldiers who were to die later in the hospital are not included in casualty figures. Those, you know, families, soldiers killed, in order to receive death benefits, they have to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Of course, we have the embedded journalists contribute to the misreporting of casualties too. Now, how embedded journalism, which is an oxymoron, became acceptable in the first place, that's a whole separate issue. But and then beyond that, this was actually a second issue that I pioneered, is that of desertion. They're not counted at all. Talking about tanks. Tanks damaged by enemy fire, if they were taken for repair and then destroyed once repairs were deemed impossible, they're not included. They were not counted among material losses. The difference, though, is the claim that 30 tanks were destroyed when, in fact, it was 850 all told, and that is all armor. So Svidrigaylov states, this is my translation, a few years ago, the performance of the U.S. military in the first phases of the Iraqi war were disastrous. They failed to perform well against Iraqi air defenses. The result was to move the operation to attack civilians. Only with the support of the media could American authorities cover its enormous losses. In 6 days of fighting, the U.S. military lost 15,000 soldiers, 600 tanks, and 18 pieces of the latest bomber aircraft in 1991. And I'm assuming here he's talking about the stealth technology. The convincing victory of the Iraqi armed forces were associated with the well-trained and experienced personnel they had, as well as the availability of reliable and modern military equipment purchased in Russia, Ukraine, and China. And for someone who came of age, 18, 19 years old in the early 90s, it's a shock, but not surprising. And it makes a heck of a lot more sense in the official story. American exceptionalism includes and stretches to the claim that its media alone and only the U.S. does not exaggerate the enemy's losses and then does not downplay its own. The American press, as we all know, is far worse than state-owned press, state-owned media elsewhere. Anatoly Matveyev, who wrote in Russian Soldier, which is a magazine, in this case published in 2012. He says this, and again, my translation from the Russian. Of course, we're talking about Iraq. The war's results for America were deplorable. The ground battle was gained at a very high price in 6 days, from February 24th to the 1st of March, about 10,000 coalition soldiers. And now he's quoting from Konstantin Kolontayev, historian and journalist, and this initially was dated in 2009. So you had this list of authorities here. 10,000 coalition soldiers were killed, and 660 tanks were destroyed. This was, you know, the first, you know, 6 days. The U.S. managed, with the support of the whole Western mass media and Gorbachev of the USSR, to convince the world this was somehow a victory. There was no victory, since the main goals set for this war were not reached. Iraq's ground forces were not surrounded and destroyed in Kuwait and southern Iraq, and the U.S. failed to overthrow Saddam Hussein's regime and install liberal puppets. Now, what I just quoted there, that's a slightly different set of figures than the official ones, of course, that we hear every day, talking about the incompetence of the American military. Often you're given the example of Iraq. And I was also shocked, and maybe not so much shocked, and people simply didn't believe me at the time, that Iraq's air defenses destroyed the myth of American stealth technology. If you were around back then, you heard about the stealth fighter bomber all the time. This was going to make America invincible because the radar couldn't pick it up. Nonsense. Soviet-era radar picked them up easy. And the whole thing was a myth. And I remember stealth technology constantly. At that time, this was the cutting edge. And you may notice that no one really talks about that much anymore. In the first 7 months of the Iraq War, the Americans and the British lost more than 300 of their newest aircraft. And of course, reporting on this would be a bit of a problem. Some of you know that in World War II, American magazines and newspapers were not allowed to show pictures of dead American soldiers. The landing at Iwo Jima was the very first time and the only time. I think there was Life magazine on the cover. Now, when they were fighting communists in Vietnam, no problem. Now, of course, the Iraqi air defenses at the time suffered significant losses too, primarily for radar stations. And they were hit from the air, of course. The U.S. had to rely on its satellites and reconnaissance aircraft. And, of course, they did have top-notch equipment for removing electromagnetic radiation from communication cables, and this is how they were able to locate Iraq's air defense command posts. So that's why in the late 90s, Iraq, with the help of Chinese engineers, replaced the old wiring with fiber, which doesn't produce electromagnetic radiation. So in 2000, Iraq bought 4 location observation stations of the Kolchuga type from Ukraine, and this damaged American dominance in the air. So the invisibility of the F-117A and B-2, the myth, of course, the invisibility as it applies to NATO radar, was exposed. But this, we're talking about Soviet-made radar from 50 years ago. Because it operates at a different frequency, a different radiation frequency, it was successful. So the Kolchuga at the time was not really, not technically a radar system. And of course, you know, I'm taking this information from these very same Russian journals. This is not an area of expertise, but it is for these authors. They're very sensitive radio direction finding station. They don't really admit anything, and therefore really can't be detected. However, they recognize targets in the air, even by rather weak radiation. Their onboard electrical and electronic equipment. But that system only has one drawback. This station alone can't clearly detect the target. It can only determine the direction from which it is moving. So for accurate detection, 3 stations had to operate simultaneously, thus forming a single triangulation coordinate system. That would give the complete and very clear coordinates of the target, speed, direction, distance, altitude, etc. So the failure of the first Iraq war, which was, I was told, we were all told, was a massive, unbelievable success. It was not. And Iraq then purchased four of these direction-finding stations, thanks to Russia. So if one failed, the state of the triangle could be restored very quickly. And it made Iraq's air defense system almost invulnerable to airstrikes. And proof of that fact was the defeat of the U.S. Air Force, the offensive in August 2002, March 2003. During the battle, 200 aircraft were attacked simultaneously by Iraq's air defenses. You know, there was a time where that was celebrated in the American press during the Vietnam War. You know, American planes being shot down all over the place. Here, it was covered up, blatantly covered up. And I remember the insults, you know, the goat herders and the reducing Iraqis to animals. And yet, this was the truth at the time. The internet was relatively new. The first Iraq war, the internet didn't exist. So it wasn't easy to get this kind of information. During the air attack in Iraq, lasting about 7 months, the U.S. and Great Britain lost 300 airplanes. Of that, 250 were American, and the air defense systems did not suffer at all. So the British lost, during that very same offensive, lost more than half of its available aircraft. And the reference book, you could look at military reference books, stating that in 2001, the Royal Air Force had about 300 combat aircraft. But in early March 2003, the same journals say that they only had 110. I'm not sure, you know, where did they all go? And, you know, because American journalists were very limited in what they can say, and it's far worse now, at the time, we weren't aware of these facts. And the daily destruction of American and British aircraft in that period of time were roughly about 10 to 12 units a day. And Russian intelligence forces sources confirmed this. So the point of all of this is to simply expose what the U.S. is, what the U.S. is capable of, why anything, any war, these ideological wars, whether it be in Iraq, Afghanistan, Russia, China, so I don't care where it is, the awful destruction of deliberate destruction of civilian centers in Yugoslavia years ago. What this really is. The American media is a leftist ideological movement that is cheering on a war against its enemies, which would include states like Syria and Iraq, Saddam Hussein's Iraq years ago, as being more or less nationalist. Calling them right wing is strange. It's kind of a silly idea, especially abroad. But nationalist is the perfect way, and social nationalist is a perfect way to describe them. These are and were legitimately popular governments. Let me give you one final example. There was just a now-forgotten article, January of 1991 from the Washington Post. This is what they wrote. A Pentagon spokesman told our reporter, Paul Parkinson, that logistical information about body bags, coffins, and other preparations to handle the dead is classified. He explained that by releasing the numbers, the Pentagon would, quote, give the enemies an advantage, end quote. Documents we have obtained show that one Marine mortuary unit and two Army Reserve mortuary units have been deployed to Saudi Arabia, but the specific number of people in those units and the number of casualties they can handle is classified. Those in these units would clean, dress, and prepare the bodies of dead soldiers for return to the U.S. Other advance work for the dead has included the installation of several large refrigeration units to preserve bodies in the heat of the Saudi desert until they could be flown home. One Pentagon source went so far as to tell us that there is a worldwide stockpile of 63,000 body bags in the Pentagon inventory, but he refused to say how many have been allocated for use in Operation Desert Shield, or how many have already been shipped there. Apparently, the Pentagon and the White House now fear that the American people's support would wane if they knew how many empty body bags have been sent over. We reported in November that President Bush had been sobered by the top-secret casualty estimates the Pentagon gave him. Those figures say that as many as 10,000 Americans could die in the first week of a war with Iraq, and as many as 30,000 could be dead if the war lasted for 20 days. I come from a military family. I don't think people realize what it's like to have an officer, an enlisted man, come to your door to say that your son has been ripped to shreds. And for nothing in these cases, for absolutely nothing. I can't tell you, you know, I've raised two boys. Even the thought of losing a son, and of course it's always boys, losing a son to these mindless, idiotic wars. It's one thing if this were a war of defense against an invader. And of course, the U.S. and Europe has been invaded by the Third World. We know that. That's one thing. Or a policeman, who are the true veterans in America. Policemen killed on the front lines against the drug trade in places like Detroit or Chicago. And they are, of course, being targeted by gangs with regime support. That's, again, that's something that at least there's some moral purpose to it. But Ukraine, China, Iraq, these are simply wars to maintain oligarchic supremacy. And quotes like I just gave you, the author that was Anderson from the Washington Post in 1991, it proves how concerned the U.S. government at the time was concerning the impact of heavy losses on the morale of soldiers and certainly taxpayers and families. The death of a son can destroy the daily life of the average family to the point of non-functionality. And the regime and the oligarchs treat these deaths as, you know, what they call collateral damage. Well, collateral damage means something else, but basic, you know, this is what we have to do to support liberalism abroad. Those of us who were following the news of the day in 1991 were daily reminded about the American desire to keep all casualty figures secret. In 2003, the Global Policy Forum ran an article about the banning of cameras from flights carrying the remains of American soldiers. And this was a policy as early as 1991. And again, you know, as I'm speaking to you, the notion of having the report of a dead son, and even those who come back, they might not be in pieces physically, but they certainly are in pieces mentally. There's no way to describe it. And you're talking about a massive, superior military force in Russia, China, whatever. You're talking about mass deaths. And if they were able to pull this off, even to this day, no one really knows this, how bad is the repression going to be if this actually takes place? I tend not to think it's going to take place, because a lost war would mean the utter and complete destruction of liberalism. Liberalism is dying a slow death. The U.S. being humiliated everywhere, and they probably will back down here. Will prove that. The failure, the destruction of the Western economy, which affects everyone, is proof that liberalism can't function anymore. But again, as I say, the cameras and pictures of caskets coming back from Vietnam were run constantly to destroy confidence in the war, because there it was a very fashionable communist North Vietnam, supported by both China and the Soviet Union. There's a myth that China didn't support them, but that's not true. The Vietnamese Communist Party was created by China. And because Hitler lost World War II, this is why the Chinese became communist in the first place. This massive anti-war movement for the against the war in Vietnam does not exist against these endless wars for nothing. Back in the early 90s, you had this old Vietnam-era anti-war movement amongst journalists. It was almost reflexive, and remember, the president was Republican. So, but that's long gone. The high higher ranks of the American military have been purged over and over again, especially as Obama was leaving office. I think it was 700 total, you know, colonels, generals, and admirals in the Navy, removed for their being unreliable. The BlackRock administration, this, you know, Biden corpse, you know, as we all know, has purged its own defenses during the inauguration, National Guard and everything else. You had individual soldiers removed. They were questioned as their ideological background. Those who command American forces today are placeholders. They're careerists. They have nothing, a promotion has nothing to do with merit. I've heard this from too many military men. Officers, mid-level officers, are pampered beyond belief, but of course, the grunt is treated as they always are, as expendable. This is the nature of liberalism. This is the nature of American warfare. And this level of adventurism and sickness in the corporate liberal elite, this totalitarian cult, using this pathetic figure of Joe Biden as their spokesman. And he can't even speak. He's like the Boris Yeltsin of our era. To try to provoke both Russia and China into a war is nauseating on so many grounds. I couldn't possibly summarize them all. But this is the nature of what's happening. This is what this saber rattling is for. And the Russians are correct. They are the orthodox power. I stand with them and always will. And I thank you for listening, everyone. I will see you when I get back from my honeymoon. Thank you very much.